Today's featured guest, Peter Schiff from Schiff Gold. Peter Schiff, chairman of Schiff Gold, located at schiffgold.com, and author of several bestsellers. Welcome back, Peter Schiff.
Well, thanks for having me back on. Happy New Year, Chris, and to you and your audience.
Very kind of you. To start off the discussion, the dialogue today with a financial meltdown. A lot of warning signs on the horizon. There's a lot of talk in the blogosphere about the potential for another 2008 credit crisis-like scenario. What do you see on the horizon?
Well, I see something worse. I mean, I've been warning about a coming dollar crisis, a sovereign debt crisis, and that's what's looming. I don't think it's going to be a repeat of what happened in 2008. But, you know, the economy is in much worse shape than it was going into the 2008 financial crisis. And that's because instead of allowing the free market to correct the problems that were caused by the Fed keeping interest rates too low in the years from 2002, you know, through 2008, we doubled down on those same failed policies and were even more reckless under Bernanke and Yellen than we were under Greenspan. And so the Fed has done a lot more damage to the U.S. economy. And so a much bigger crisis is coming. And we're not going to get off as easy as we did in 2008. And there's not going to be any bailouts to ease the pain, because I think the U.S. government is going to be right at the epicenter of this next crisis. What they did is they blew a bubble, and it's not really a bull market in stocks. It's a bubble in stocks. I mean, you know, a real bull market would have growing earnings. That's not what we have. We have share buybacks. We have corporations that are not investing in plant equipment. They're not building for the future. They're just, you know, eating their seed corn. They're just going into debt to buy back their own stock as they're undermining the long-term viability of their business model. So this is probably the biggest bubble in history, and it's not just a bubble in stocks. It's a bubble in bonds. It's a bubble in all sorts of debt instruments, from high-yield junk bonds to, you know, bonds backed by automobile loans or student loans or you name it. The government has inflated a bubble in it. Pretty much the only thing there's no bubble in is gold or other commodities. I mean, there you're in the opposite of a bubble, because everybody is convinced that the dollar is a one-way ticket up and that the Fed's policies were so successful that they're now going to be raising interest rates for years. And that's the opposite of reality. The Fed's policies were a disaster. As a result, they're going to do them even bigger. We're going to have interest rates back at zero before too long, and we're going to be doing another round of quantitative easing, which I think will be bigger than the first three rounds combined.
At the Fed funds futures rate at the CBOT, it really looks like we're going to see 1 to 1.5% interest rates by the end of next year. But you seem to think that that can't hold for long.
You know, most people expected the Fed to have begun raising rates last year by June. And instead, they didn't raise them at all until December. And they waited to the point where the U.S. was on the cusp of another recession. In fact, the Atlanta Fed came out on the first day of the new year and reduced their estimates for fourth quarter U.S. GDP growth to just 0.7. 0.7, not even 1% annualized, and that may be too optimistic. If you look at how bad the economic data has been in the fourth quarter, we could easily have a contraction. We can have a negative print for the fourth quarter GDP, and if that is the case, we could have another negative quarter in the first quarter, in which case we're officially in a recession. Now, is the Fed going to be raising interest rates when we're in a recession? I don't think so. You know, there's no precedent for that. I mean, I think they're going to have to reduce rates back to zero and, again, do more quantitative easing. So I think all of these estimates of much higher interest rates in 2016 belie the economic data. And I think as more and more people wake up to reality, you're going to see those forecasts change. And eventually the Fed is going to change its rhetoric, too. They're going to have to find a way. They claimed they were data dependent, but they really were calendar dependent. I mean, they just wanted to raise rates before the end of the year, even though the data would argue for a reduction in rates if you're going to follow the Fed's playbook.
Yeah, the timing was very suspicious here, unless one really believes their numbers. I mean, if you believe unemployment is really, you know, around 5% and inflation is nil, but I know there's at least 50 to 100 million people who aren't experiencing that type of positive trend.
Yeah, well, employment numbers, I mean, even if you believe them, they're a lagging indicator, right? I mean, the unemployment rate doesn't tell you anything about where the economy is headed. It tells you where it's been, right? A strong economy will produce jobs. But if you look at the forward indicators, right, the indicators that let you know where the economy is headed, they're all flashing recession. And so, you know, employers don't start laying people off because they think a recession is coming. They start laying people off when they're surprised by a recession that they didn't forecast. And I think that's what's going to happen. I think we're going to get a lot of layoffs. But the reason that the unemployment rate is so low, it's not because we created a lot of good jobs. It's because a lot of people left the labor force, and therefore they're no longer looking for jobs. And a lot of people threw in the towel looking for full-time jobs and reluctantly accepted part-time jobs. And so if you look at the people who are underemployed or who are not in the labor force at all, the labor picture is actually quite bleak. And then if you look at real wages and you see that people are actually earning less money today than they were when the recovery began, and that's, you know, unprecedented. And not only are people earning less, but the average net worth of the typical American has declined dramatically during this recovery, and the home ownership rate has plunged to the lowest level in almost 50 years. And you've got record numbers of kids in their 30s still living at home with their parents. So this is not a recovery the way anybody, you know, anybody imagines it. And this is a scary thought. If this recovery was this bad, imagine what the next recession is going to look like.
Now, half of kids under the age of 30 are living at home. That's half of the most productive. But I wanted to ask you, though, about the greenback. You know, we've seen this dollar rise now for over a year. It looks poised to break out to new highs. We've seen nothing but strength here. Obviously, euros and yen and other currencies flowing into the U.S. as the least bad currency on the block. Give us an idea of what this is going to mean for the markets.
Well, first of all, the dollar has really been rising since mid-2011. That's when the dollar kind of bottomed out. Actually, it bottomed out in April of 2008. That's when the dollar was at its low point. But it had a big rally during the financial crisis, then sold off again, and then kind of didn't quite get down to the 2008 lows in March of 2011, but it got close to it. And then it's been rallying, and it really went into, you know, hyper mode probably starting from the summer of 2014, had a huge run. And it's all this is based on the belief that the U.S. economy is in great shape, and that Ben Bernanke was a hero who saved us from, you know, a repeat of the Great Depression. Supposedly, we've done everything right. We're the strongest economy in the world, and everything is great. And that is a complete fantasy. But remember, the people who believe in this are the same people that thought everything was great in early 2008, including everybody at the Federal Reserve. They're the same people that thought it was a new era in 1999 during the dot-com bubble. So, historically, the mainstream Wall Street crowd and the media have not recognized the problems. They continue to believe that bubbles represent legitimate economic growth. And so this is the biggest bubble yet, and it's going to make a lot of people very poor who have been betting on the U.S. dollar, because I think the dollar is going to collapse. And when that does, obviously the price of gold is going to go up. And by the way, you know, gold prices were down in 2015 in dollar terms, but they didn't go down nearly as much as everybody thought. And in terms of most currencies, gold was actually up in 2015. But, you know, I think that it's going to be in a much bigger bull market in 2016, because I think it's going to go up against the dollar as well. And so far, it's off to a pretty good start in 2016.
But what do you say to naysayers who say they've heard of this dollar collapse now for a couple of decades, it seems like? I mean, you could even argue that it was, one of the hedge fund's big trades.
Well, the dollar was on the verge of collapse probably in 2008, and ironically, it was saved by the financial crisis. You know, it was on the verge of collapse too in 1980, and it was saved by Volcker and Reagan. So it's been close, but it's always somehow gotten a reprieve. But eventually, we're going to run out of luck here. And I think the problems are now so enormous that the next time the dollar goes down, I think it's going down for the count.
Well, obviously, if the dollar goes down, I mean, we've seen, look at Venezuela, pesos and whatnot collapsing. That led to a massive gold rally, at least in terms of their local domestic currency.
Well, who knows? I mean, the dollar has the potential to lose a tremendous amount of its value. And, you know, I don't want to find out how much value the dollar loses with dollars, right? I want to be safely invested in the countries that I think are in better shape, whether it's Switzerland or Singapore or New Zealand. I want to own plenty of gold bullion, plenty of silver, and then I can watch from that vantage point. Because I think a lot of people who have bet on the dollar, you know, not only are these bets going to be losing bets, but they can be catastrophically losing bets. And as the dollar really starts to roll downhill, policymakers to continue to do the wrong thing gets greater and greater, because the worse the crisis becomes, the more painful it becomes, and the more embarrassing politically it becomes to do the right thing. And so they continue to look for expedient choices which just accelerate the crisis.
Gold, obviously looking at a break at perhaps around 1,000. Do you see maybe 800 before we find a solid bottom? I mean, obviously, we're going to see a lot of volatility in 2016.
Well, I mean, I don't think gold prices are headed below 1,000. It's not to say that they couldn't go below 1,000. I just don't think it's the likely scenario. I mean, there are a lot of people that believe that. I mean, I think if you look at the speculative community and the hedge funds, they've never been this short gold or, you know, this, and so there's a very crowded trade short to gold market. It's the same people that are long the dollar, which is probably an even more. So, I don't expect gold to see those levels. And I think people that are waiting to buy gold at 800 are going to be very disappointed because they're not going to get that opportunity, and they may end up buying it at 1,300 or 1,400 instead, because they, you know, I think I would rather just buy it now. I mean, you know, right now it's around 1,070, 1,075. I mean, I think that's you know, a gift horse as far as I'm concerned, and so just buy it, you know. And if it turns out that gold goes below 1,000, okay, then somebody else got a better buy than you, or maybe you'll be able to buy some more. Maybe you'll have some more money at that time to take advantage of that. But I wouldn't want to refrain from buying any gold at all, hoping to buy it all at 800 and then be stuck with nothing when it doesn't go down there. It just goes up. And I think once this thing turns, once the dollar story turns, once the Fed is cutting rates and doing QE4, I mean, gold's going to go up like a rocket ship. I mean, I think the speed at which gold rises and the magnitude, I mean, people are going to see gold, I think, up $50, $100 in a day, maybe several days in a row. So it's not going to, you know, go up slowly the way it came down.
I think there's some precedent for that. I mean, look at what happened to silver, of course, back in 2010, 2011. Just bounce around $12 to $15, and out of the blue, we're at 25, 35, 45. And you could see something similar if that momentum you refer to picks up with the yellow metal.
Yeah, I think it'll be worse than that last time because, you know, a lot of the silver supply, you know, was bought through these ETFs, and same with gold. Then when the ETF holders dumped their shares, all that physical metal was sold off. And I think that if all the people that used to own the gold and silver ETFs in 2010 and 11 and 12, if they try to put their money back into those ETFs, there isn't enough physical supply to satisfy that demand. Because a lot of the gold that was bought when those funds were liquidated is held by central banks. It's totally off the market. It's not going to come back. So there's very little physical supply. And especially if you look at the paper markets, you look at the amount of people that are out there that are short gold, silver and gold, who could end up being forced to try to deliver. Because I do think that in a physically supply short market, you're going to see a lot of people who have paper claims trying to convert those claims to real physical ounces. And I think you're going to see delivery notices sent out to a lot of shorts. And, of course, there's no supply. There's nothing to buy. So the prices could just go up just so dramatically in such a short period of time. I wouldn't want to press my luck by trying to buy it a little cheaper.
What do you say to the folks who think that there's just this excess of bullishness, you know, from the last run we saw in 2010, 2011? You know, is that a myth?
Bullishness. When I go on television about gold, all they do is laugh at me and make fun of me and say, you know, this is, I mean, there was a guy, I just, you know, when gold prices were moving up on the first trading day of the year, you know, and kind of they said it's in reaction to the tension in the Middle East, the reporter who was talking about it, who said, well, you know, it's kind of counterintuitive that you would think gold would be considered a safe haven asset. I mean, people are laughing at it now. They're saying it's not even a safe haven. I mean, they're basically saying there's no reason whatsoever to buy gold. There has never been this much negativity. I mean, the market is more negative on gold today. Yeah, I mean, if you look at gold stocks, which are an indication of the sentiment towards the future price of gold, because stocks discount what people expect to happen in the future. I mean, stock prices discount earnings, and obviously gold company earnings, what people expect gold companies to earn, is a function of what they expect the price of gold to be. And if you look at gold stocks, I mean, most gold stocks today are trading for half, if not less, than they were 15 years ago, you know, in 2000, 2001, when the price of gold was still below $300 an ounce, and it had been declining for 20 years, right? I mean, today you're getting stocks for, you know, half that price or less, even though gold is almost $1,100. So the price of gold is up almost fourfold, yet the mining companies have been cut in half or more during the same period of time. So I don't think the sentiment on gold has ever been this low, despite the fact that the fundamentals have never been this good. I mean, when have we had a situation where all the major central banks had interest rates at zero? When have we had a situation where some central banks had negative interest rates, where they were doing all this quantitative easing? It was always, well, why own gold? Because if I own dollars or euros or yen, I get 3 or 4 or 5% interest. I don't get any interest on gold. So, you know, why give up interest and own non-interest bearing gold? Well, now, not only do you have fiat currencies that bear no interest, you actually have negative interest rates. People buying European bonds with a negative yield. I mean, obviously, a zero yield is better than negative. And of course, the supply of gold is growing very slowly. We've never seen the supply of fiat currencies growing more rapidly. So this should be a perfect storm for gold. But the fact that it hasn't rallied more is what's creating all the negativity, despite the fact that it's already rallied from under 300. Gold almost hit 2,000 a few years ago. Now, I got to 1,900. Yet all people talk about is the drop from 1,900 to 1,100. They forget everything that happened on the way up. But I think we're getting ready for a bigger leg up that's going to take gold above $5,000 an ounce. And of course, by then, yes, when gold's at 5,000, a lot of people are going to be talking about why they should be buying it. But, you know, why wait for that to happen? And meanwhile, a move from, you know, where we are now to 5,000 is no bigger than the move from under 300 to 2,000. In fact, it's actually smaller.
I mean, it's a bit ironic that, you know, the argument they keep trying to, the bears keep trying to give us about how the rate environment is the worst in the world. But you look at the EU, obviously, we're seeing further and further into negative territory. That makes the barbarous relic even more appealing.
And if you look around the world, I mean, look at demand coming from foreign central banks, look at the demand coming from places like China, India, Russia. They are loading up on gold for a reason, right? And I think they can read the writing on the wall. They know the dollar's days are numbered, and they want to hold real money. They know that in a post-U.S. dollar reserve currency environment, what's going to replace the dollar is going to be gold, because the dollar replaced gold. I mean, it wasn't that it replaced the pound. I mean, the world was on a gold standard prior to Bretton Woods. And the reason that the dollar was able to supplant gold was because it was backed by gold and redeemable in gold. So it was interest-bearing gold. That's what it was. But now that people realize that the dollar is not only redeemable by nothing, not only is it not redeemable gold, it's not redeemable in anything, the U.S. government is broke, the U.S. is the world's biggest debtor nation, we are on the verge of a massive collapse, so obviously the dollar can't survive as the reserve. So what is going to replace it? I mean, it's not going to be the euro, it's not going to be the yen, so what's going to replace it? Obviously, the only thing that will work is what worked prior to the dollar, and that's gold. And so I think the smarter countries are preparing for a remonetization of gold.
All right. What do you say, though, to the technicians in the audience who are looking at gold hovering now under resistance, and it really looks like we're going to see a push down to 800? What would you say to that argument?
A lot of people thought it was going to go to 800 last year. It didn't happen. And I don't know where they say. I mean, to me, it looks like we're probably putting in a pretty nice bottom here, maybe even double bottom, around the 1050 area. I mean, we, you know, the market is trading again around 1075, and we haven't pushed down. And if you look at gold charts in terms of the Canadian dollar, the, you know, the Australian dollar, the euro, I mean, the charts look a lot more constructive than against the U.S. dollar. And, you know, so the question is, what's more likely, that the bull markets that gold is now enjoying in terms of a lot of other currencies reverse to bear markets, or the one place where gold is having a bear market in the dollar, that moves in line with all the other markets? I think it's more likely that, you know, the bull market that gold is having in all these other currencies extends to include the dollar rather than all the other currencies seeing gold go back into a bear market.
There are several things that seem to be coming to a head here. The younger generation moving back at home can't find opportunity. We see over half of Americans receiving some type of federal assistance. Food stamps approaching 50 million. We've lost at least 10 million high-paying jobs, about 500,000 per year now for almost 20 years, flowing out of the United States. Have we completely gutted our middle class? Is that a cliche now?
Oh, the middle class. Middle class has been, you know, under attack for generations now. I mean, probably the heyday of the middle class in the United States was the 1950s, and it's probably really been downhill ever since, and it's obviously accelerated. But think about what it meant to be middle class in America in the 1950s. I mean, it meant that if you had a high school education, If you had any kind of job as a man, right? I mean, you know, you didn't have to have a white collar job. I mean, you could be a mailman, you could be a policeman, a fireman, a butcher, baker, a candlestick maker, right? You had any kind of steady job. Your wife didn't have a job. You could support her. You had four kids. You didn't have debt. You didn't have credit card debt. You were saving for your retirement. You might have even had a housekeeper. And in fact, if you had a profession, if you went to college and you worked a white collar job, you had live-in help. Not only did your wife not have a job, she didn't have to do the housework because she had full-time help. Middle-class households defined as making $40,000 a year, when two people are working. I mean, two people making $20,000 a year, that's middle class. And in many cases, they have college degrees and they're barely making that money. You know, and not only do they have these college degrees and low incomes, but they have student loans to pay. They have credit card debt. They have auto loans. Maybe they have a mortgage if they can even afford to qualify, or they're just renting. So the whole middle class lifestyle has imploded. It doesn't really exist. I mean, women are having children now in their 30s and 40s because they can't afford to have them in their 20s. I mean, my mom had me when she was like 21, and that was normal. You know, and my mom didn't have to work. My dad was an insurance salesman, but that was, you know, that's all you needed. You just needed a job. You know, and you can support a family. But today, you know, even with two jobs, people can't afford to support their family. They can't afford to have kids. So the family, maybe they have one kid, two is pushing it, right? And still, they have to go into debt. The average American family today has nothing saved for retirement. They're dead broke. They've put all their hope on a government-run Ponzi scheme. The middle class is already eviscerated, the death of the middle class, but it's the government that killed the middle class. They killed the middle class with redistributive welfare state policies, with high taxes and high regulation. Capitalism built the middle class. Free enterprise, the gold standard, you know, no income tax, no Social Security tax. That's why we had a middle class. And then the government killed it with taxes and regulations and inflation.
No, exactly. And by forgetting that it was the mom and the pops, as you refer to, the entrepreneurial spirit. But I'd also like your thoughts then on the jobs of the future.
Well, look, obviously, you know, there's so much opportunity in anything related to technology and biotechnology. I mean, if you're a smart guy, you can learn some of these things. But you don't need to learn it in school. I mean, one of the beauties of the Internet is that information is there. You don't have to go to a college or a university to get access to it. You know, one of the reasons that universities, people went to them in the past was because they had these great libraries, and that's where you can get the books. And they did have professors, but you can get all this information. I mean, never has it been so easy to be self-educated than it is today. And of course, there's never been a better time to do it because the cost of getting educated through a conventional university has never been more expensive. So why waste your money paying for an education when you can get a better one on your own? But also, if I were American, I would be looking abroad. I mean, it's so much easier to start businesses in other countries. Not every country. Certainly, there are a lot of European countries that make it very difficult too. But there are countries around that you can go if you really want to start a business and you want to have the best chance of success. Because in America, it's not easy to succeed. I mean, it's not easy to succeed anyway. I mean, succeeding in business is not that easy. Otherwise, everybody would do it. But the government makes it a lot harder with taxes and regulations. The burden, the hurdle that you have to, jump over to succeed is much higher than it otherwise needs to be. And so people can get more opportunities in countries with more freedom.
Any other themes that we haven't covered that you see for 2016?
I think the big game changer for 2016 is going to be the success of the Fed's monetary policy and the legitimacy of the U.S. recovery. When people begin to realize that, and we are not, a blueprint that other people should emulate as far as QE, right, that it's been an abject failure in the United States. You never know how bad monetary policy fails until the central bank tries to end it, right? I mean, we saw that in the 1990s. We saw that with the housing bubble, and we're going to see it in a more spectacular fashion with this bubble because, again, this is the biggest bubble yet. The U.S. is in the worst economic shape that I think it's ever been in, and I think that our understanding of economics, on the part of the people who are in charge, right, has never been this bad. I mean, if you look at the people who run the Fed, you look at the people in Washington, their understanding of real economics is probably at a nadir as far as in American history. So if you think of all the policy mistakes that led to the Great Depression, right, because that was a failure of government, not a failure of the free market. The Great Depression was created by Hoover and then by Roosevelt through their government policy. And it may have started with the easy money of the Fed, but it ultimately was exacerbated by the policy mistakes of Hoover and then Roosevelt. In fact, in many cases, Roosevelt simply expanded the mistakes that Hoover was making, because I think we you know, our level of understanding is even further away from reality than what it was back then. And if you look at the electorate, if you look at the people who are voting, look, Bernie Sanders has raised more money from more people than any candidate in U.S. history, and he's outright about the fact that he's a socialist. And so that's where the mentality of the typical American has moved. That's how far left we've drifted in this country, where the most popular candidate, as far as contributions, is a socialist. You know, the problem with socialism is the more socialism that you have in an economy, the more it destroys the economy, and therefore it creates an environment for more socialism. Because as you get more socialist policies, you undermine the economy, particularly for the middle class and the poor. And now as the middle class and the poor get poorer, they look at socialism as the solution. So, you know, it basically sows the seeds of its own future success, which is actually failure from the perspective of anybody who's voting for these policies. You know, and we're at the point now where, you know, so many people now are in such bad shape economically because of the socialist policies of the past, that the socialists have a great opportunity to advocate even more of those policies as a solution to the problems they created, because the people voting for these policies can't connect those dots.
But isn't the panacea retooling, retraining, you know, re-educating our workforce for a modern future, which is, you know, less of what we saw in the past?
Has to happen without government. I mean, you don't want the training happening in some government paid for classroom. That's not going to work. You want the training happening on the job through the private sector. You want, you know, free market training and education with a profit motive and with competition. That's what works. Not the government trying to do it through some, you know, through schools and overpriced tuitions and bloated educational bureaucracies. But, you know, ultimately, when people start talking about we need more education, we need more training, they assume it's something that government has to provide. But that, you know, we don't want government to provide it. Whatever government provides isn't going to work. And, you know, a lot of people that do go to universities and colleges don't even get an education. All they're there to get a diploma. Right. And, you know, they'll study the limited, you know, just a limited amount of time. They'll cram for their exams the night before the exam. And they'll retain the information just long enough to answer the questions. But then ask them anything a week later, they don't even remember it. Right. It's all short-term retention. And, you know, meanwhile, they go to parties, they get drunk. Right. I mean, you know, that's it. They just want this little piece of paper that says I have a degree, and they think that that's, you know, the key that's going to unlock, you know, a great prosperity for them. First of all, the sororities and fraternities, I mean, they have libraries of past tests, and some of these professors are so lazy that they don't even want to take the time to come up with a new exam. They just have the same exam every year after year, and the fraternities already, you know, they got them all. And in fact, even if you learn something, I mean, you take a look at somebody is studying philosophy or English lit or poetry or sociology, and let's say you actually learn this stuff, right? What good is it going to do you? What kind of job are you going to get where you actually need to know about anthropology or sociology? I mean, how many jobs are there for anthropologists? Not that many. You know, all these people end up going to law school.
I mean, you understand that there's a lot more to an education than just getting a job. I mean, a liberal arts degree, you know, that transcends much of your life.
You can get that on your own. And I think that what college could be, yes, it's a social experience, a rite of passage, but it's way too expensive. You know, if college was still, you know, affordable the way it was, you know, when my dad went. And, you know, when my dad went to college in 1940s and 1950s or whenever he went, yeah, I mean, he had a job. He worked his way through college. He waited tables over the summer, and he sold magazine subscriptions. And that's all he did. I mean, and all of his friends, because my dad came from, you know, a lower class community. Of course, you know, he had eight sisters. His mother didn't have a job, and they did have a housekeeper, you know, but he was lower class. You know, he wasn't even middle class. You know, his father was a carpenter. But they didn't have money for him to go to college. So, he worked his way through college like all of his friends did. But, you know, wealthier people, you know, if you were in the upper middle class or upper class, you just cut a check. I mean, there was, you know, college was not expensive. Nobody borrowed money to go to college. It wasn't until the government got involved that people started borrowing money, because the government loans is the reason that college is so expensive. And so now you need the loans because the government has driven the price so high. But at one point, yeah, you know, wealthier kids, they went to college, you know, just for, you know, the intellectual experience of it all, just so they could be well-rounded. Today, the educational establishment and the politicians have sold us on a bill of goods that, you know, you need to have a college degree to get any job. And meanwhile, you now have record numbers of people with college degrees who wait tables, who drive Ubers. I mean, a lot of companies probably use that as, you know, like a gatekeeper, just to try to screen people out. But, you know, I think that you can get through that. I mean, I think more and more people are going to choose not to go to college because they're going to do the cost-benefit analysis. Think about all the job experience you could get, you know, from 18 to 22 if you skip college. And I think a lot of people who, you know, are 18 can get jobs that a lot of college grads are getting, just offer to work for less money. And, of course, you don't need as much money because you're probably still living with your parents and you don't have any college debt to repay, is 4 years of on-the-job work experience. And if I was an employer, and I am an employer, I'd rather hire a guy that had 4 or 5 years of work experience than a liberal arts degree. They try to pretend that, well, because they do these studies and they show that college grads on average earn more than, you know, non-college grads. But that has nothing to do with the college. It has to do with the individuals, you know, because the smarter people tend to go to college because that's what they're told they need to do. But it's I think those individuals that earn more with college degrees, they would have also earned more had they not got college degrees. They're earning more because of who they are, not because of the fact that they went to college. And I think as more, you know, motivated, intelligent, hardworking, driven people decide that college is a waste of time and money and skip it, I think they're going to earn even more money as a result. And I think, you know, you look at some of the most successful young Americans today, the ones that have started their own companies, and, you know, they didn't go to college, or if they started, they didn't stick around to graduate. You know, they don't even know what they want to do when they're 18. They just go to college, and, you know, they just waste their time. I mean, I tell people, look, you know, don't go to college right away. You know, work a little bit, try to figure out what you want to do, what you're interested in, and then decide whether it makes sense to go back to college and study what you're interested in, as opposed to just, you know, people don't even know what their major is going to be. They're just there. And then, you know, by the time they graduate, I mean, whatever they end up doing may have absolutely nothing to do with what they studied. At least, you know, find out what you want to do. I mean, I've talked to my own son who's, you know, going to start high school next year. And look, you know, when he graduates high school, I mean, maybe he'll go to college, maybe he won't. I mean, you know, he can come work for me, he can do things, he can, you know, decide what he's interested in. I mean, he might, you know, he may end up learning a lot more. In fact, he'll probably learn a lot more working at my businesses, working with people who are actually doing things, and just, you know, spending time in a college.
But, you know, in the 80s and 90s and the early 2000s, I mean, for the middle class, you know, and suburbia, there were so many jobs available simply because most folks, you know, they were working, their parents commuted. There was a void there, a vacuum to be filled.
In a free market economy, there are plenty of jobs because people are starting businesses all the time. They need help, right? There's human beings, we want everything. There's no limit to what humans want. And so there's all sorts of opportunities for businesses to be created to satisfy the unlimited desires of humanity. And so in a free market, you're always going to have lots of employment opportunities. What happens is the government comes in and creates all these artificial barriers with all these taxes and regulations. It makes it impossible for entrepreneurs to start businesses or expand businesses. And so as a result of that, the employment opportunities diminish, especially when you reach a situation in a democracy where politicians try to get votes from employees by promising all kinds of freebies from their employers. And so all of a sudden, politicians start, forcing employers to provide health care, leave, environments that are free from stress and discrimination or exploit, you know, all sorts of things, and mandating this benefit and that benefit, and, you know, maternity leave and non-discrimination, and, you know, all the and minimum wages and all the things that they do punish employers for hiring people, you know, the result is that fewer employers exist, and the ones that are there hire as few people as possible. I mean, the government has created all sorts of incentives not to hire people. And people respond to those incentives.
You talk to people trying to find work, and they agree with you. Employers are pensive. They're nervous. They don't want to take a chance on virtually anybody because they're afraid of getting caught, getting stuck with someone who, as you say, is going to need leave and this and that and the other.
You can sue somebody for age discrimination if you're over 40. Once you're over 40, protected from age discrimination. So a lot of people, too, you know, they hire part-time workers, they outsource, they automate. I mean, you know, the most dangerous thing to do in America is to hire somebody. Because the minute you hire somebody, you subject yourself to all sorts of fines and litigation and taxes. It's you know, to the extent that you can hire nobody, you know, that's exactly what you want.
Peter Schiff, tell people more, please, about the services you provide.
I have Europacific, there's Europacific Capital, which is europac.com, and that is my brokerage firm, my asset management company, where I help people invest internationally in global stock markets and bond markets in countries where their monetary and fiscal policies are less reckless, where you have more freedom, fewer regulations, lower taxes. So people can contact me there at europac.com. If you want to buy some physical gold and silver, Schiff Gold is the new name of my gold company. Schiffgold.com is the URL. And, of course, people can follow me on the Internet. Schiffradio.com is where I host my podcast. My YouTube channel, you should subscribe to that at the Schiff Report. And, of course, I put out a lot of written material on my website. You can read my newsletters and subscribe there at europac.com, EUROPAC.com. And my most recent book, which I think is more timely than ever, if you haven't read it, The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country.
Peter Schiff, we want to thank you for taking time for us, and I wish you and your family a very good new year.
Same to you guys.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.